Podcast is made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium in Urbana. With a theme of interesting wines for interesting times, the Corkscrew is hosting a tasting this Saturday, March 5th from 2 to 6 p.m. of wines from South Africa, featuring everything from Chenin Blanc to Syrah. Information at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Poet Suji Kwok Kim is our guest today. Her first collection of poems, Notes from the Divided Country, was published to great acclaim in 2003. Among the honors it has received, the Walt Whitman Award. Her recent poems have appeared in several publications, including the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and Slate. She's also been featured on both All Things Considered and Weekend Edition. Suji Kwok Kim is visiting the University of Illinois to do a reading at 4:30 this afternoon, the 2nd of March, in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. The Illini Union Bookstore is located on South Wright Street in Champaign. She joins us this afternoon in the studio to read some of her poems and talk about her work. And listeners, I welcome your phone calls. You can join the discussion this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, poet Suji Kwok Kim. She was educated at Yale, the Iowa Writers' Workshop, Stanford, and Seoul National University, where she was a Fulbright scholar. Her collection of poetry, Notes from a Divided Country, is published by the Louisiana State University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Suji, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me here.
An article that appeared in Salon about you said you began writing poetry when you took a workshop in college. What led you to that workshop, and did you have any inkling when you signed up for the workshop that you were putting yourself on course to become a poet?
I had no idea, actually. I was an English major, so I had studied poetry for the entire time I was an undergraduate student, on the critical and analytical side. And I thought, and it was my very last semester of college, so I thought, I have to take this from the other side, the creative side, before leaving. But I had no idea how much I'd love it, and I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah. What is it specifically that hooked you on writing poetry?
Well, I think because I started out as a musician before I was a poet. I played the piano, I played the flute, I sang, and I did that all from a pretty early age. I started at age 5. And so I think that and I also have perfect pitch. And so I think just having that musical training really predisposed me to love poetry out of all the literary forms, you know, compared to playwriting or fiction or nonfiction writing, just because it is the most musical and depends most on sound as well as meaning.
Yeah. But also language is very important in poetry.
Oh, very much so.
And it's interesting, you mentioned your interests were poetry, you know, studying poetry and music. And preparing for the program, I came across something that Robert Pinsky had written about language. And reflecting on language, he said, it is almost as if we sing to one another all day.
That's a wonderful thing to say.
Yeah. Do you think writing poetry demands the poet listen closely to the song of language.
Oh, very much so. When I teach my students, I always try to emphasize to them that every line of poetry is an act of listening as well as an act of singing. And we just did a very basic poetic question, which is the question of enjambment a few weeks ago. And that's simply the line break. And that's the single most distinguishing feature that differentiates poetry from prose. And to me, that blank space at the end of each line of poetry is always that, there's always that split second hesitation where you're listening for where the line will go next, where the sentence will go next. And in miniature, it's always that encounter with the unspoken as well as the unspeakable. And then the poem goes on, you know, just that split second hesitation. But that's where the listening comes in, I think. And it's incorporated into the very texture of the poetry.
Yeah, very interesting. What's the term for the break in the line?
Oh, it's enjambment. And, you know, the word jam is like door jam, J-A-M-B, or like jambon in French. It stands for, I think it comes from the same word as leg, yeah, you know, walking from one line to the next.
Yeah. Well, now we're talking about language. It was also interesting to discover that your great-grandfather was a linguistic scholar and imprisoned during the Japanese occupation of Korea. The Japanese had outlawed the Korean language, and this has happened elsewhere in the world, in Ireland, here in North America with indigenous peoples. What does it mean when that kind of silence, a silence of language, is imposed on a people?
Oh, it's kind of a shockingly, I mean, it gets to how we communicate with each other at all. In fact, in the case of the Japanese occupation of Korea, people had to even change their names to Japanese names. And so it gets to the very, you know, question of identity, even personal identity, individual identity, as well as national cultural identity, obviously. And I think that it's, if poetry is constantly singing to each other, now I've forgotten the Pinsky quote, what happens if we can't sing to each other? What happens if we can't tell our lovers that we love them in the language that we know and we grew up with and you know, we're born with? Yeah. And it gets into the very, very fabric of dialogue and conversation between people.
Yeah, it is almost as if we sing to one another all day. And it's also interesting to reflect that poetry comes from the oral tradition.
Yes.
And that it was a way for people to hang on to memory.
Yes.
And to stories. Does that add to the power of poetry for you?
For me, it is, because in my particular case, I was trying to write down, or at least riff off of, some of the stories that my family had remembered. So for them, it was obviously, in some ways, a collective act of memory, where it was not just my own memory, but the memory of my family, the memory of the stories that they had been told when they were children about people that I had never met before, like my great-grandfather, for example, who passed away before I was even born. So one critic, I think in the Yale Review, when reviewing my book, she used the term post-memory, which was interesting, which is that I'm writing about things and I'm remembering things that occurred before I was even born. And I thought that was really interesting, because it is a collective act, and it is also a collective act of singing.
Yeah.
It's a collaboration.
Well, maybe this would be a great time to ask you to read The Tree of Unknowing, because it has to do with what you were just talking about in terms of the reviewer. Was it Yale?
The Yale Review,
The Yale Review.
Okay, this is The Tree of Unknowing, which I've actually never read before, so I'm really delighted to be asked to do this. The Tree of Unknowing. Uncertainty, take me into the forest, leaf by leaf, where an immigrant sits in a Jersey slum, a young mother rocking her child. Where, along the endless road, are you going away from me like a cloud, like a cloud, like a cloud? I lay on your arms, watching your lips sing. I touched your chin with my tiny fingers. Your loneliness sang to me, each word a crumb of light burning in the skull, until a galaxy of sparks flashed among the branches, lighting the way where? I lifted my head. What was it I saw in your gaze, the maze of you, corridors of years, corridors of war, black wheat hair ripening, the last shape sown in closing eyes. The words have their own woods. Where the words can't go further, where the woods begin that make us mad, too real and not real enough. Whose memory was it? Why did I feel such joy? Look, the cloud tree will never die. I wonder who you were. I wonder because you were.
Suji Kwak Kim reading from Notes from the Divided Country. She read The Tree of Unknowing. Talk with us about this idea of the cloud tree.
Oh, the cloud tree. Well, that was sort of a joining of two different ideas, I guess. There's the mystic text, The Cloud of Unknowing, of course. And then I was also thinking of the biblical text, you know, about the tree of knowledge, and so what a tree of unknowing might be, for example. So those two things came together.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions or comments for our guest, Suji Kwak Kim. She's a poet. She's visiting the University of Illinois to do a reading this afternoon at 4:30 in the author's corner of the Alana Union Bookstore, located on South Wright Street in Champaign. If you'd like to join us this afternoon, if you've got a question, you'd like to make a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What would you like to tell us about your family's history?
Oh, well, it's difficult to know where to start.
It's got to be a big history. But maybe you could, I'm sure people are listening, who are listening might go, well, I wonder, you know, what happened to her great-grandfather and, you know, where maybe you'd pick up the story from that point.
Sure, I'll start chronologically. Well, when my great-grandfather was a linguistics scholar in Korea, he was also a dean of Yonsei University, which is one of the two or three most important universities in Seoul. But when the Japanese invaded Korea and occupied it in 1910 officially, although they had been there since 1905, that's a very complicated historical situation. But when they came, you know, it wasn't as brutal as I had mentioned before with the outlawing of the language really until the 30s. It was not until the Japanese were also trying to invade China and Southeast Asia. They were also engaged on the Eastern Front with Russia. It was not until then that they really sort of clamped down, you know, in terms of their own occupation. But at that point, that's when the language was outlawed, as I had mentioned. That's when Koreans were forced to change their names to Japanese names. It's also when they were forced to worship at Shinto shrines, even though it's a specifically nationalistic Japanese religion. So at that point, that's when my great-grandfather was imprisoned for several years. And, I mean, they're just some amazing stories that obviously I couldn't write about in the book. In some ways, they were also almost too difficult to sort of make dramatic. But so my grandfather on my mother's side was in the South Korean Army later in the Korean War. My grandparents on my father's side were from the North. So when war broke out, when the Civil War broke out, people were escaping south, but I think they had no idea that the division would be permanent, that it would last for 50 years. I think they just thought that they would see my father and his siblings in a couple weeks. They're like, we'll catch up with you down south. And I just think they had no idea that they'd never see them again. So that's on my father's side. And then on my mother's side, her family was from the south, so they all sort of survived intact. And then, but there'd be amazing stories where, you know, my mother's mother, my grandmother, who I also never met, she had five children, starting from age 10, my aunt, and age 8, my uncle. My mother was age 5. There was a 3-year-old, and then there was a baby. And there'd be these incredible stories where she would take the five children and walk up a mountain 200 miles to get away from the fighting, and so on, and then eventually escape down to the southeast, the Busan corridor, which was the only sort of safe spot for much of the war because it was protected by the UN. And, you know, it's hard to take five kids to the A&P. I'm just sort of amazed that she could do that. And again, it's not dramatic, but it's just everyday constant occurrences like that for surviving through war. Another occurrence, I think, happened when North Korean soldiers came. They were staying in Seoul, and the North Koreans had occupied Seoul, but they, you know, for at that point, they had spared the women civilians who were left behind. But they knew that, for example, my grandfather on my mother's side was in the army. And so they came in, and my grandmother's there with the five kids. And, you know, they're like, oh, where's your husband? We're going to shoot you if you don't tell us where your husband is. And she bluffed. She said, well, shoot me, but you have to shoot each one of my children first in front of my eyes and then shoot me last. And for some reason, it moved him. And he said, well, we'll come back tomorrow, meaning get out of here and don't be here tomorrow. Okay. But, you know, just stories like that over and over. I mean, and I'm sure the same is true of every other family who lived through the war as well. I mean, it didn't leave any family untouched, I think.
Yeah. And this has got to have some significance, obviously, for the title, Notes from the Divided Country. But at the same time, that's not all this title refers to.
Right. Well, I mean, I suppose there are many divided countries, obviously. There's the question of being from an immigrant family, and therefore, originally, one is from another country. And then there's also being in America. And I think that is something that almost everyone has gone through here. You know, there are sacrifices that everyone's family made to be here to provide a better life for their children. And it's just so moving. And so that's one, I suppose. And then another could be simply the traditional division between body and soul or body and mind. There's that one as well. Especially since, I guess, in this particular case, I was thinking very hard about, in the first poem, what it was like to be born. I was imagining that. And of course, you know, the body is wonderful. It's miraculous. It's sensual. But it's also the sight of mortality. It makes us vulnerable to suffering and physical pain, aging. I mean, all sorts of things. Appetite. We have hunger. We feel thirst. You know, those sorts of things. So I was thinking very hard about all those questions.
Yeah. Maybe you would read next for us. Maybe you would read Middle Kingdom.
Sure.
Which happens, I think, which is about those that divided country that is one generation from another.
Okay, great. Middle Kingdom. Gruel, crumbs on a table of ice, a labyrinth of snow, and infinite distances in the small box of the kitchen. Mother chopped pieces of her heart into the skillet. Brother and I heard oil sizzle until we huddled in shame. She salted the meat with tears. She cried if we ate, and cried if we refused to eat, warning, you'll go hungry. Each morning, her heart grew back. Each evening, father went away. Where? While she cleaned room after room, not knowing when he'd come home. What was the rest of their story? Between them lay silences, secrets lost in the hissing woods of happiness and unhappiness. Giant ghosts haunted the halls. Father, mother, sister, brother, dwarfed by our other selves, dwarfed by who we never became. Mother prayed every night. For what? Brother couldn't speak, but spoke by beating his skull against the floor. I hated the words that never broke, whatever spellbound our house. But when she caught my eyes open, I shut them and bowed my head, pretending to say grace, pretending to pray, so as not to frighten her.
Middle Kingdom. Tell us a little bit about your mother.
Well, she was almost born on the same day as me, oddly enough. We're only separated by 3 days. And the story of the book at least begins, the first four poems deal mostly with her story and my father's story. And they were immigrants. They came about a year before I was born. And so they had very poor medical care. And in my mother's case, she had me and she was pregnant with me. And then when I was born, I ripped her womb. And the thing about that, though, was that, you know, she was bleeding a lot after delivery. And I think she just had a very old-fashioned or, you know, incompetent doctor. I'm not really quite sure. And he was like, oh, it's, you know, it's normal after delivery. And then just wait it out. And then so she eventually healed, obviously. But because it wasn't stitched up properly, her womb shrank. And so for my brother's case and my sister's case both, there just simply wasn't enough room for them to develop normally. So they wound up with, you know, very severe mental and physical disabilities for both of them. In my brother's case, they couldn't figure out why that had happened, you know, because they ran all sorts of ultrasounds and genetic tests, and he was normal that way. But it was simply a lack of space. And then they really didn't figure it out until my sister was born. So I think that I'm hoping that medical science has really come a long way since then. But
yeah,
it was completely preventable in my view.
Yeah. And that's something that you explore in an earlier, the poem, I think it comes before Middle Kingdom, where you ask your brother's forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
the last line is, "Lie to me, forgive me for being born."
Yeah.
It's much too long to read on the radio, but it's a very important poem to the book.
Yeah. Writing these poems, the process of writing them, is it cathartic or is it painful? You know, these are very difficult themes that you're dealing with.
I think it's both, actually. And my teacher, Frank Bidart, once said that one should write about only the things that one must write about, you know, the things that sort of drive you to writing in the first place. And so it is both. You know, obviously it's painful to sort of write about such matters, but also, you know, one understands them after really thinking about them in a poem. And so it is cathartic. And it's also a great way to see that life isn't only that as well. Like, one can see the larger picture.
Yeah. You mentioned Frank Bidart, and he wrote a very nice piece for the back of the book, and he calls it brilliant, unerasable. That's a great word, and that's a great way of in one word, saying something very important about Notes from the Divided Country. These are things that can't be erased, shouldn't be erased.
Oh, it was the most amazing thing to receive via email.
Yeah.
He really understood the book.
He wrote, "This is a brilliant, unerasable book. It begins with the descent of the soul into flesh, which is also the descent into the catastrophic, tormenting history of family and nation." I wanted to go back to that article that I mentioned earlier of from Salon.
Mm-hmm.
You were quoted, and it was such a marvelous thing to read, your thoughts about poetry, and I want to share this with our listeners, and then maybe we can. There's so much here. There's so much in one paragraph here. It's amazing, and so maybe what we can do is I will read it, share it with our listeners, and then we can, you know, tease out some of the ideas that are here. Poetry emphasizes the moment and the minute.
The minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. The moment and the minute. Thank you. And unrepeatable processes of the soul making itself. You feel the enormous pressure put upon language because each word has to be chipped out of silence and chosen out of desire. When you read a great poem, you get a sense of continuous danger that the poem won't go on. That blank space at the end of each line isn't just spatial, it's intellectual and emotional. It confronts what's ungraspable in our lives and can't be put into words. That's a lot. The processes of the soul making itself.
Well, I think it had come from my thinking about Wallace Stevens. He once defined poetry as words chosen out of desire. So again, you know, that is where that comes from. And I thought that, you know, the poet Ellen Bryant Voigt once called poetry a process of continuous decision making. So I guess I put those two things together in my mind, and I thought that, well, then poetry is actually continuous choices, continuous soul-making. Every time the soul decides to choose a word or choose, and that's in miniature, and then on the macro level, every time you choose something to love, that you're making yourself. You're choosing yourself every step along the way, every hour.
And this was great fun to read and to think about. When you read a great poem, you get a sense of continuous danger that the poem won't go on. That you're going to be left with some work to do, I think, too, as a reader, as someone listening to a poem or reading it.
Well, there's that famous Frost quote where he talks about how the speaker has to be put into legitimate danger so that they can be legitimately saved. So I suppose, you know, that sort of informed that sentence.
Yeah. And also I think, and maybe we can talk a little bit about how you approach reading someone else's work. But for me, there is that kind of tension in the course of a poem. It's like, where, pay attention to each word because it is very carefully chosen. But on the other hand, maybe I should let go of this somehow, but it's hard to do. Is like, where are we headed? You know, what's coming next?
That's very true. And what's true on the micro level, line by line in a poem, is true on the larger level in all our lives. We don't know what will happen next, and we have to choose it.
Yeah. I don't know, though, if that level of anticipation is always the best thing.
Can be nerve-wracking.
Yeah. Well, how do you, when you read someone else's poetry, how do you approach a work?
You mean when I read it out loud or to myself?
Well, either way, I suppose you would do both, and that you would feel it would be a different experience, both reading it to yourself and reading it aloud. So let's start with reading it to yourself.
Oh, well, reading it to myself, I guess I place more emphasis on the visual just because it is on the page first. And then I'm always fascinated to see how different poets sound exactly like themselves often. You know, they have their own tone, they have their voice, they have their diction, they have recurrent imagery and concerns that come up poem after poem. And then it's great fun to read it aloud because, you know, one hasn't been inside the decision-making process, you know, line by line, choice by choice. One wasn't that soul at the time that had created that poem or written it. And it's this momentary and really kind of deep connection with another person's creative process when reading something out loud. You're like, and it's great fun because you don't have to do the work yourself, really. you can, well, except imaginatively or, you know, ethically or in terms of empathy, obviously. But you don't have to do the actual slogging through words.
You can celebrate the work.
Yeah, you can really appreciate it. And that's really wonderful. And you have to do that because otherwise you're always, you know, inside your own head. And it's really, and in the end, it's really about communication with others.
Yeah.
It's a dialogue.
Yeah. Do you ever take someone else's poem and type it out as it appears on the page? Or
I did that in grad school quite a bit because just the feeling of it appearing on the computer or on the typewriter as you go along is really kind of wonderful. And, you know, especially since we all have our own particular fonts that we're fond of, you know, it sort of makes it look almost as if you had written it, but obviously you haven't. So that's kind of an interesting exercise, too.
You know, thinking about your metaphor of chipping words out of silence, I wonder if in a way, and you're talking about the appearance of a piece of poetry on the page, I wonder if in a way you're approaching paper when you write like a sculptor, you know, might look at a piece of stone.
That's very true and really interesting. And there's also, now I've forgotten the word, but among both Korean and Japanese potters, there's a certain sponge called an ear, and you put one on the inside of the pot and one on the outside of the pot, and it's as if they listen to each other as they're forming the pot, which is really wonderful. And also because then the inside of the pot, becomes this sort of active space rather than simply absence or emptiness. You know, it's this active pushing outward that then forms the shape of the vessel that you're making. So I just have always loved that.
Yeah.
I forgot the word, of course.
also, it seems to me that, you know, you mentioned the potter. The words in your poetry, I think, are very tactile. Does it feel that way when you're writing them?
Oh, definitely.
Do you feel through your fingers or through your skin, your sense of touch?
Very much. I happen to love words that do crackle in your mouth, that almost feel like there's some physical, palpable presence there. Those do happen to be my favorites. One of my very first favorite poets was Gerard Manley Hopkins, who, of course, has diction like that all the time. I mean, fall, gall, and gash themselves. You know, that kind of crackling, smoldering diction.
Mm. You want to read us let's talk with a listener. We've got a listener calling in now. If you put your headphones on, we can talk to our first caller this afternoon. Let me reintroduce our guest. Our guest is Suji Kwok Kim. She's a poet, and she's joining us this afternoon in the studio to read some of her poetry and talk about her work. This afternoon, a little bit later this afternoon at 4:30, she'll be in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore on South Wright Street in Champaign for reading a talk and a book signing. So you can see her later this afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore. If you'd like to join us this afternoon, if you'd like to join the discussion with the telephone call, we'd love to hear from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with this listener on line one, caller in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I'm sort of a poet, but not nearly as esteemed as Suji or Ted Kooser, who's the National Poet Laureate. My question is, how about the use of metaphor? He talked about it a lot when he gave a reading at the public library. Does she believe in the use of metaphor? And just to have her talk about that.
Okay.
And thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for your question. That's wonderful. Metaphor, it's interesting. When I talk about it to my students, I often delve back into the etymology of a word because it really sort of reveals its secrets in that way. Metaphor comes from metaferen, which means to carry across. And so I always think of metaphor as speaking about one thing in terms of another. You know, you're carrying across or you're transferring those qualities. And, you know, the most sort of, everyone talks about my love is a red, red rose as the classic metaphor. But even something like the wind sang through the house is a metaphor because it's a verb-based metaphor. But instead of having to say, you know, the wind sounded like a song through the house, you know, you can compress it like that. But it does then transfer the qualities from one thing. It carries them across from wind to singing. And so I think that it's at the heart of what poetry is about and how we do that. And then I also think about what King Lear, remember Cordelia in King Lear, where she says, unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. So in some ways, we're carrying across what's in our hearts to what's in our mouths. You know, that way they can be heard and shared by others. I really think that's at the heart of poetry.
Hmm. Would you read another poem?
Sure.
Why don't you select?
Okay. Should it be from the book or a new one?
It could be whatever you would like.
Okay. Let's see. I'm going to read a very short one called Prelude for Grains of Sand because that also has that diction that you're talking about. And it's pretty short. Beyond the harbor with its tackled and roped masts, beyond the coastal shelves, lamp shells and bladder rack, where beds of mussels clack, where barnacles and wentle trap crack the green hooks, where cockle and quahog drift through dulse, sea whip, urchin, blood star, you sang to me, angel of unknowing, angel of nothing. You sang me beyond song.
Hmm. Lots of crackle. How is it that a series of poems come together in a book? How do you select an order for them?
Oh, that was very difficult. The funny thing about this particular book is that when I first submitted it to the Walt Whitman contest, it was a very different book. The entire first section didn't exist, and it was in a very different order, simply because the process of submitting to a contest takes so long. You submit usually in November of one year, at least for this contest. You don't even find out about it until May or June, and then another you know, another year goes by before it becomes published. It appeared in April. So the process is very long. And in this particular case, I was not prepared for it to be published. I was just sort of sending it out to see how it would do. And then when I learned that I won, I was in kind of a panic. I was like, oh, it's not ready. I need to write all these poems that don't exist yet. They absolutely need to be there, especially, you know, the first section, the section about being born. So I just sort of, you know, pushed them and begged them and pleaded and asked for more and more time. And in the end, I wound up with about 12 poems that were different from the one that had originally been selected by Yusuf Komunyakaa. And, you know, the first four poems, for example, are the last four poems that I wrote. And the first poem is the very last poem that I wrote for the book. It was right down to the wire.
That's interesting. Well, that explains why you won the Walt Whitman Award in 2002, but the book was published in 2003.
Right. Right, and that's very common for all the contests.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting to me because, in a book of poetry, you know, you're moving from one poem to the next, and, you know, you don't read it all in one sitting, but, you know, once you put it down after a couple of poems, when you pick it up again, you kind of want to know, where am I going next, you know? And so I was just always curious about how it is that you make an order for us.
Well, I guess it's somewhat analogous to the process of choosing, you know, putting lines in an order as well. It's just larger. And in this particular case, I knew that the last poem in the book would be The Korean Community Garden in Queens, which ends with the word one. So I sort of knew that the first poem had to be about being nothing and then how the overall arc of the book would go from nothing to one. But it was very intuitive. I mean, it was really haphazard and disorganized, and it took me forever to write that first poem. It was really difficult because, you know, there's no other poem like it. There's no poem about being born. So it took so long, which is why it was the last one.
Yeah.
But it had to be there. It absolutely had to be in the book.
Yeah. When you write a poem and you know, you have a poem there on the page, on the paper, but when do you come back to it and what kind of revision do you do? Do you do a lot of revision?
I do a lot of revision, actually. In fact, I've revised some poems that already appeared in the book when I read out loud. I cross out things. I cut things.
I noticed you added a word in the first poem that you read for us this afternoon. Sorry, I interrupted you.
That particular one was a mistake, but but I often
it was a minute mistake.
But I often, you know, do little editing as I go along, especially when reading. This, for example, appeared in the Times, but I still revised it afterwards after it was published, and I think that's just a personal idiosyncrasy.
Yeah.
But, you know, Paul Valéry very famously said that a poem's never finished, it's only abandoned. So that point of abandonment is different for everyone, I think.
Interesting. What kind of courses do you teach? Who are your students? Are they interested in writing poetry, or are they blossoming poets, or are they, you know, students who are, you know, taking a course about poetry?
Well, it's a real mixture. I teach at Drew University in New Jersey, which is about 50% of the students are local. They're all from New Jersey. And so some of them want to be poets, but many of them are just taking it, you know, because they're writing minors or because they're interested, but they don't want to go on to become poets. Every once in a while, you know, I have at least, even in the 3 years that I've been there, I have about four people who went on to graduate school, though, in writing. And, you know, all over from Arizona to England to North Carolina and San Francisco. So, you know, there are few people who are very, very serious about it, definitely. Half the time I teach poetry writing and the other half the time I actually teach fiction writing, which
really?
I don't know anything about. But it's only because it's such a small university that they can only afford to have one writer.
I was going to ask you if you tried your hand at fiction writing.
No, only teaching it.
A professor of English here at the University of Illinois is a guest from time to time here on the program, Philip Graham. He's a writer of fiction, of short fiction and novels. And, you know, he is a lover of poetry, but he has a great frustration with some students who are so shy of poetry, hesitant, you know, like they're afraid of it. And what's been your experience as you, not only as you work with your students at Drew University, but as you visit college campuses for readings and lectures, and no doubt you go to classrooms and talk with students?
Well, it's really interesting because in other countries, like, for example, even when I was in Korea, every taxi driver could recite poetry. And I think the same is true in Ireland. When Seamus Heaney has a new book of poetry out, they put it on the chalkboards in the pubs. And in Latin America, the same thing is true. It's not something that has this cult of difficulty attached to it. And I think there must be something. And I remember that, too, in high school. I was like, we were reading poetry, and the teacher would be like, what does that mean? And, you know, it would put so much pressure on the students. And you know, I think that there is this sort of overly early emphasis on critical analysis and meaning and interpretation, rather than simply loving the music of poetry first, and then you can always get to that later. But it sets up this barrier, this real, and it's pretty common all over the United States. I don't think it's true in other countries. I think it must be the pedagogy in terms of how poetry is first taught, you know, to high school students or elementary school students.
So we need to have a little bit more fun when we're younger with E.E. Cummings and and think of poetry as Puddle Wonderful and enjoy that bird walking down the walk. And,
oh, absolutely.
You know, that kind of thing. Are there things we might do to better appreciate poetry?
Well, I think there are initiatives that are out there. You know, the various poet laureates, for example, that caller was talking about, Ted Kooser. And in the past, there are other ways of that other poet laureates are trying to sort of work against the marginalization of poetry. You know, there is that favorite poem project where, you know, it again invites the participation of people from all over the country to really read their favorite poems aloud. And again, there's no like necessary analysis of the poems. It's just because they're loved. And, you know, the same is true before that. Billy Collins put together an anthology as well of people's favorite poems. I don't know if, you know, people who read novels are asked what that means so much. You know, they either love a story or they like the characters, or, you know, there's not as much of an emphasis on difficulty and analysis.
Yeah, there's something not so frightening about a book club. Now, how often, I wonder, do reading groups select a book of poetry?
I don't know. I mean, I know it's happened. I've gotten letters in the past from various book reading groups, but I think generally they choose novels.
Yeah. Would you read? Would you read one more poem for us this afternoon?
Sure.
Again, your choice. Maybe you'd read something that's not in the book. I don't know. Well, you've got the book there. Either way, whatever you'd like to do.
Okay. I will read something new, and it will actually be different in tone from the other things I read. It's a poem called Slant, and I guess the only thing that you need to know is that the last line riffs off the observation by Paul Celan that think and thank come from the same root. Slant. If the angle of an eye is all, the slant of hope, the slant of dreaming, according to each life, what is the light of the city? Light of Lady Liberty, possessor of the most famous armpit in the world. Light of the lovers on Chinese soap operas, throwing barbecued ducks at each other with that die while you still have your hair, take me kind of love. Light of the old men sitting on crates outside gigaw shops, selling dried seahorses and plastic temples of heaven. Light of wigaramas. Light of the suntanners in Central Park turning over like rotisserie chickens sizzling on a spit. Light of the pluck you and gone with the wings fried chicken shops, the glamazons, the immigrants, the peddlers, stockbrokers, and janitors. All of us making and unmaking ourselves, hurrying forwards towards who will become one way only, one life only, free in time, but not from it. Here in the city, the living make together and make and unmake over and over. Quick, quick. Ask heaven of it, of every mortal relation, feeling that is fleeing, for what would the heart be without a heaven to set it on? I can't help thinking no word will ever be as full of life as this world. I can't help thinking of thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Suji Kwok Kim has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Her book of poetry, Notes from the Divided Country, is available from the Louisiana State University Press. Later this afternoon, she'll be at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner for a reading at 4:30 this afternoon, the 2nd of March, the Illini Union Bookstore located on South Wright Street in Champaign. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, we should have settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, after a turnaround Tuesday in the bean pit yesterday, where futures finished the day lower, last night they made a move higher, and they managed to continue that through the day today, up about 13 3/4 of a cent in the nearby March contract, everything else up between 12 and 14 cents for the day. We'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services of Oakland, Illinois about that, and some interesting things, too, on the wire services about the corn pit. Now, they finished pretty much unchanged for the day, just slightly lower, in fact, but the wire service is reporting that they believe that there's been a net change in the corn position, that it's moved from approximately 114,000 contracts short to 20,000 contracts long. So while the corn position at the Board of Trade in terms of number hasn't changed a lot today, over the last week or 2 weeks, the position of those holding open positions has changed quite a bit. And that may mean quite a bit over the next several months, too. We'll talk all about that during the closing market report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. That's just a few minutes away. From the wheat pit today, the March contract, a 3.32 settlement price. They were up 2 for the day, with a high of 337 and a low of 331. May futures 346.5, the high, the low at 338 3/4. The settlement price there at 340.5, up 2 1/4. And July futures at 352 high, low at 345. A settlement price at 347 1/4, up 2 3/4. September contract 356, the high, the low at 350.5, and a settlement price at 352. Just about didn't get that out. Up 2.5 cents for the day. December futures in the wheat pit, 366, the high, the low at 358.5. A settlement price at $3.60, up 4 cents. We have a Fibonacci number to talk about this afternoon, if you know what that is, today too as well. After those big couple of up days in the retracement of off the lows in the wheat pit, I think 38.5% was the retracement. That's a Fibonacci number. Probably chased everybody out who had any gainers in it, and this thing may be looking for a place to go. The decision whether will be made fairly soon as to whether it's going to go up and down, or down, that is. March corn now, 215.5, the high, the low at 209, settlement price at 210 1/4. They were down 3/4 for the day. The May futures, 224, the high, the low at 217 3/4, settlement price at $2.19. They're down 0.25 cents for the day. July futures, 231 high, low 225, settlement price at $2.26 1/4 in the July corn, down 0.5. September futures off 0.5 as well, $2.37 the high for the day, the low at 231 1/4. They settled at 231 3/4 in December futures, 244 the high, the low at 239. Settlement price unchanged today at $2.40. March futures at 248 3/4 high, low at 245 1/4. They settled at 246 even, and they were unchanged on the day. March oats from the Chicago Board of Trade, $1.75 1/2, the high, the low at 172 3/4. Settlement price there at 174 1/4, up 2 for the day. In the May oats, a 158 high, low at 155 1/2, and a settlement price at 156. They were down 0.5 for the day. From the oil processors in Brazil, they have the main one anyway, commercial side, has lowered their estimate for the Brazilian soybean crop down to about 58 million, just above 58 million metric tons. That's on par with what most people have begun to think where that crop is. Interestingly, in those numbers, they did not really lower the exports, so that would be the competition that U.S. farmers are facing. Beans here in the United States still up 13 3/4 cents for the day. March contract, a 6.18 3/4 settlement price, the high at $6.23, the low at $6.13. May futures, 6.33, the high, the low at 6.20 1/2, a settlement price at 6.27 1/4. They were up 14 on the day. And July soybeans, $6.37 the high, the low at $6.25.5. Settlement price at $6.32.25, up 14.75. August futures, $6.35, the high, the low at $6.26.5. And a settlement price at $6.31.5, up 14 for the day. September futures, $6.30, the high, the low at $6.22, settled $6.24, they were up 12. And November beans, $6.27.5, the high, the low at $6.19.5, and a settlement price at $6.24. They were up 19.75 for the day. March beans settled, bean meal that is, $186.50, the high, the low at $183, and a settlement price at $186.20, and they were up $4.60 for the day. May bean meal, $188.80, the high, the low at $185.60, a settlement price at $188.60, up $5.30 for the day. March oil, $23.32, the high, the low at $28.82, settlement price at $23 even, up $30. And the May bean oil, $23.54, the high, the low at $22.94, settlement price at $23.11. And they were up 20 for the day. Now here's Les Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd, it was a higher day today for cattle, but a lower day today for lean hogs and March bellies. March feeder cattle, 101 even, the high, 98.85, the low, the settlement, $100.32.5, that up 35. April, 99.70, the high, 97.55, the low, the settlement, 99.22.5, that up 35. May feeder cattle, 98.80, the high, 96.60, the low, the settlement, 98.32.5, that up 35. March live cattle, let's skip past that one. April live cattle, 87.15, the high, 85.35, the low, 86.80, the settlement, that up 30. June, 83.10, the high, 81.60, the low, 82.92.5, the settlement, that up 30. April lean hogs, 75.95 the high, 74.45 the low, 74.65 the settlement, that down 60. May, 77.75 the high, the low, 76.60, the settlement, 77.05, that down 15. June, 81.15 the high, 79.90 the low, 80 even the settlement, that down 55. July, 77.50, the high, the low, 76.40, the settlement, 76.47.5, that down 62.5. March pork bellies, 90.25, the high, 89.35, the low, 89.35, the settlement, that down 67.5. The Dow off 38 points at 10,792, the NASDAQ off 4 at 2067, and the S&P 500 down 3 at 1208.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Rose LaRue from Chicago, Illinois writes, Dear Dr. Science, why do men whine so badly from a simple common cold? Is there actually a greater effect on them by this virus? If so, why is this?
Men are especially sensitive when it comes to pain. They don't feel pleasure as keenly as women do. And whining has been an adaptive advantage for them in soliciting pity from women.